Hi everyone, my name is Anne. I'm a bit emotional, but I'm also an alcoholic, and they go together. Yes, I'm from the very southern end of the mainland of Australia, and that really is part of what I wanted to start with. In 1980, I was coming over here as an Australian World Service delegate. I was going to the World Service meeting in New York. And on the way, I visited Akron, Ohio. And I went on the tour to visit Dr. Bob's house. I went all through the house. I bought a little mug saying on it, "I drank at Dr. Bob's." And then towards the end of my visit there, I went out onto the front porch and I sat there on the top step. And I started getting goosebumps. I thought, this is exactly where Bill and Dr. Bob sat when they were the only two sober alcoholics in the world. They sat together and they talked about this wonderful thing they seemed to have found. And it was so wonderful, they were saying to each other, "We can't hug this to ourselves. We've got to pass this on." And as I sat there, I thought, that message came from this very spot all around the planet and down south to nearly to the South Pole to reach me, and it gave me my life. And I still find that very awesome, just the feeling. I've got a photo of myself sitting there. Someone took the photo of me sitting where those two wonderful men sat. And as a result, it's always been very important to me about this carrying the message, and I started to analyse or find out as much as I could about how the message actually got to me along that long path. And it started when I was just a little kid. My father was a doctor. My grandfather, maternal grandfather, was seriously in trouble with drinking. And my father was very interested to see what he could do to help. And he got the message first. In 1942, a psychiatrist in Sydney, Australia, read an article in the American Psychiatrist's Journal about this new movement called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was very struck by it, so because he worked with a lot of alcoholic patients. So he wrote over to that magazine or journal to inquire further, and his request was passed on to Bill at the headquarters in New York. And they sent him a big book, one of the very early ones, and he was sharing that then with his patients. And the more he learned about it, the more he wanted to pass the message. So he wrote an article about it in the Australian Medical Association's journal, and my father read it. And so he started to discover maybe here's an answer for my grandfather. And at that time also, he started to talk to us kids. Now, I was only about six at the time this happened, but he was telling us, This alcoholism is a disease, so that means anyone can get it. That means that you could possibly find yourself with it one day. So be very, very careful, he said, how you drink. And he wanted to teach us kids how to drink the right way. So the only drinking that happened in our house was my father and mother would have a glass of sherry when Dad got home from work to unwind, and then they'd have a bit of wine with their dinner at the dining room table, and that was it. So that's what I was taught. You have to have white wine with white meat and red wine with red meat and so on, and in the right glasses. But on the nights that happened, I volunteered to clear the table, and I was out in the kitchen draining everyone's glasses. I didn't know the significance of that at the time, but I learned that as I grew up. Around about 1947, there was a visitor to Melbourne, a famous actress, Lillian Roth, and she was spreading the message about Alcoholics Anonymous on the radio. And these are all these different ways that the message gets spread. And also, my aunt was an avid reader of the Saturday Evening Post. And one day she turned up at our place with a big stack of old Saturday Evening Post issues and thought we might like to have them. So here am I at the age of 7 or 8. I'm reading that one, the Jack Alexander article. And I remember all the photos in it of the Bill sitting with his New York group and talking together. And I was filled with awe at this wondrous thing. And then in 1949, my father came to America. He did research on tropical diseases mainly, and he was coming to do some research on scrub typhus, which was prevalent at the time in the Rocky Mountains. And he decided he would head for find out more about this AA for my grandfather. And he went to a meeting in California, and he told us kids about it when he came home. And shortly after that, the guy who spoke at that meeting and told his story came to Melbourne, moved to Melbourne, and was on the radio. And I remember my father saying, "Listen to that man. He's a walking miracle. He's a sober alcoholic, something the world has never seen before." Now, this is, I really feel like I was being stalked by AA all my life. I still hadn't really started to drink. I didn't start to drink until I left home at the age of 20, moved away to be a teacher in a distant school. But I started to drink then, and that's it really started to look like there might be a problem. In my second year, my fiancé came across a copy of the Big Book in a second-hand store for 5 shillings. We'd already switched to decimal currency then. And it had names crossed out in the front. And I began to read it, and it blew me away because I was reading about me. And that book haunted me the rest of my drinking years. It didn't stop me straight off, but it frightened me, and it frightened me so much I had to drink more because I couldn't cope with the fear. And I drank on for about 10 years. At the age of 29, my fiancé walked out on me. He couldn't stand the drinking. And I was spending every night then lying face down, unconscious, in my flat by myself. Nobody knew I was there, and I was heading for death. And there was one day I was trapped in an organisation that, you know, never knew how to say no to people, and they asked me to be the secretary. So I went to a board meeting one night, sucking my peppermints, and they had a new director there that night. And after the meeting, he was talking, and I'm listening, and I'm thinking, that sounds familiar. And I said to him, "You ought to read that big book, that book, Alcoholics Anonymous." And he says, "Well, as a matter of fact, I have read it. In fact, I'm a member of AA." Now, this was the thing that saved my life, a person carrying the message by being open about his membership. I wouldn't have made it to AA. I would have died because I was too afraid to go there by myself. And I've always followed this pattern myself that if the opportunity arises, I will mention it to somebody that I am an alcoholic, or rather I more often say I'm a member of AA, because you get two different reactions. If you say you're an alcoholic, they sort of, you see the attitude come out on their faces. A negative attitude. If you say that you're a member of AA, they say, "Oh, that's wonderful." And then they want to know more about it. But when I was first getting sober and I had to I was moved to a new school, I was finding it very difficult to get through a day at a time. And I did talk to a superior in my school and put him in the picture, and he helped me a lot. And then when I moved to another school, I found when I got there, that school already knew that I was a member of AA, that all passed it on. And one day, as a result, the principal turned up in my classroom and he said, "Listen, I want you to come with me. The sports teacher will take your class." And he took me out and he says, "I've got someone to talk to you in another room by yourselves." And one of the parents, a mother of one of the children in my class, had come up to the school. She was very worried because of what happened in their family the night before, that dad came home viciously drunk, very abusive, and ended up with him chasing the family down the street with an axe. And she wanted to know if her little boy was all right that day at school. And the principal had come to me and said, "Listen, you can help this woman." Now, isn't that wonderful? That's the respect that AA has if they know that you're a member. So I have always made it a very special importance to me of how to carry the message. I look at the ways that it reached me in the press, in the magazines, on the radio, now TV and films and the web, internet, that there are so many ways that we come up with ideas in our district of how we can do these things. And you won't be able to see this, but we've developed this little card instead of a meetings book. It has a QR pattern on it. And one of our local members in Melbourne has developed a website called aameetings.org.au, and you just point your mobile phone at it and we'll take you immediately to that website, and you can put in what day you'd like a meeting and it will tell you at where is the closest meeting to you on that day. And we're spreading those all around the schools where all the kids are mobile phone fanatics, and in the youth centres. That's another way we're carrying the message. We have, because of my teacher experience, the district has sort of encouraged me to develop a schools program. We write to all the schools around, and we have developed this program where about five or six of us will go to a school. First of all, we write to the schools. We tell them what we do, and if they would like to come and have a chat, like us to come and have a chat with their kids, this is how we go about it. We make sure that they know exactly what we're going to do, because they really are in charge of the children. They're responsible for what they put in front of the children. So they make me MC because I'm used to standing in front of a class and speaking. It's a bit different from this particular experience, but, and then I tell them some brief details about AA, what it is, what it does, and then I get them to all watch the video of AA and young people. There's two reasons for that. So the children in the class can see young people and hear them telling their stories. But the AA members that have come to talk, they're all very nervous, of course, and they sit and listen to these stories being shared. And it's like sitting in a meeting, and it gets their heads into gear and they feel much more at home. So then we'll have, after the video, we'll have two or three AA speakers tell their stories. And in between times, I will tell the kids about the websites and we'll talk about the literature. We give them some. And then we have question time. And we've developed a pattern of taking an Al-Anon member with us too, because we found that a lot of the questions are coming from kids who have an alcoholic in their families. So that's one of our specialties in our district, and we're getting the call now from other districts and even interstate to come and tell them how we are carrying the message to schools. And there's one little thing, and I might finish on this because I must have finished up my time. We invite AA newcomers to come with us in this little team effort. We say, you don't have to do anything, just sit and listen and watch. and maybe you'd like to do this one day too. So we're carrying the message to the newcomer about service. And one day we had a young woman there. She'd be in her early 20s. She was 6 weeks sober when she came. She only came to observe. But right towards the end of the hour session that we had, we asked her, would she like to say a few words? And she did. She stood up and she came out with the most wonderful stories about how when she was at school, AA people came to speak at her class and she was sitting down the back, 14 years old, thinking, oh, this is not going to happen to me. And she says, and here I am. I'm now in AA and sober, so you just never know. There was a couple of other little things I've mentioned as a close off. Carrying the message, being alert to any opportunity possible. Yesterday, I was feeling very tired from jet lag, and another fellow Australian came with me, and we took a taxi back to the hotel. And the taxi driver says, what is this place? What are you doing, all you people, at this convention centre? So we told him. And then he started to tell his story. He was the oldest child of an alcoholic parent, and he was a Sudanese refugee, and they had to get rid of his father back to Sudan, and he wanted to know how he could find out more. So we gave him the website of AA and the website of Al-Anon family groups. And he was very thrilled. Any little opportunity, excuse me. And we have one other little thing I'd like to share. In my home group, we have a special ceremony for some of our anniversaries. We usually just do it for every fifth anniversary. We call it the cupcake ceremony. And on a person's, say, 10th anniversary, we will get 10 cupcakes, not a big anniversary cake, but 10 cupcakes, and each cupcake will have one candle. When it comes time for the ceremony, we turn out all the lights, and in our meeting we're sitting around the table and everybody's got a cupcake in front of them. But the chairperson lights the first candle, and this is Bill W., And the light is the message. So that candle is taken and it lights the next candle. And then the person with that cake takes the candle and lights the next cupcake. And gradually in the darkness, the light is spreading, just like our message spread all the way from Akron, Ohio, to me in south of Melbourne in Australia. One by one, right around the table, and everybody's faces are lit up now with the light, and they all become very emotional. That the anniversary is celebrated not particularly for that person whose anniversary it is, but for the whole fellowship and the whole meeting. We all participate and we all pass on the message of the next candle. And it's a really beautiful ceremony. Have to be careful as you get a bit older, because my last ceremony had 45 cupcakes and we nearly set the room on fire. But yes, it's been a real privilege to come in and share these things with you, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this convention. Thank you.
I'm struck by the scope, really, of our 12th step and carrying the message, and the how many different ways there are to carry the message, probably as many different ways as there are people in this room. The important thing, I suppose, is that we do carry it. And I was also struck with the Anne's history, the improbable history of AA, and how it sort of leapfrogs from one person to another, one place to another, and it providing a very, very tenuous thread for for people to get sober. I know in my own life, it was a very fine line between drinking and sobriety. And I found myself on a street corner in New York City, drunk, looking to go home to get some more money to come out and keep drinking. And I ran into a fellow that I had used to drink with that I hadn't seen for a while in the neighborhood. And I was really in a rush to get home and get the money and keep drinking. But we stopped and chatted, and he asked me where I was going, and I said I was going home. And to be polite, I asked him where he was going. And he looked at me, and he cocked his head to the side. I was drunk at the time. And he said, "I'm going to an AA meeting. Do you want to come?" And I went. And I turned, and I can remember feeling as if a door had opened. I had just stepped inside, and I could feel the door close behind me. I was safe. We all carry the message in different ways, and I'm looking forward to hearing from our next speaker, George M. from Michigan.
I'm George. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from, according to my badge, Milford, Michigan, USA. And my home group is the Milford, Michigan, USA group. We just call it the Milford group. The light is going to make it a little hard for me to read my notes. So, my sobriety date is April 1st, 1974. And I speak, I ask if others have share my April 1st sobriety date to put up their hands so I can... Do we have any others? Oh, yeah, there's one. We're a small subset of AA, but we're proof that any damn fool can get sober in this world. I'm going to talk about... Get off topic, right off the bat, and talk just for a second about the 2020 convention, which is going to be in Detroit. And not from Detroit, you probably have heard a lot of bad stuff about Detroit and late night comedians making jokes and stuff. I want to stick up for Detroit. I was born and raised in Detroit. My parents were born and raised in Detroit. All my grandparents were born and raised in Detroit. All of my eight great-grandparents were living in the Detroit area at the time of the American Civil War. So I am a Detroiter. And Detroit is one of America's great cities. And it has obviously gone through some tough times with the recession and the development of the auto industry and the increased foreign competition and all this stuff. But the downtown area of Detroit, where the convention is being held, has been thriving for years and hosts huge conventions. They really know how to throw a convention. And it's an area of Detroit that is safe with interesting things to do, and it's going to be a great convention. So I hope that we'll see you there in 2020, and I guarantee you, you'll have a great time there. Back on topic. You know, when I got the call about this, asking me if I wanted to speak on this panel, I sort of had this vision of what that would be like. There would be four or five of us up here at a table, and in front would be the 30 or 40 people that might want to come to this. I see I was half right. This is a very great crowd, and I get a little nervous when I speak to so many people, especially if it's being recorded. But, I'm going to start off oddly with a story about my mother. As I say, I grew up in Detroit, and in our house, at Christmas in the living room, of course, we had the Christmas tree and all decorated and the gifts under the tree. I have two older sisters. They're actually quite a bit older than I am. Their names are Adolph and Cruella. And I was about 5 years old, and it was Christmas time. And my mother came in the living room, and I had taken out all of the gifts that had been wrapped for my older sisters and me, and I had put them in three rows, one for Adolph and one for Cruella and one for me. And she said, you know, Georgie, what are you doing? And I said, I pointed to the rows, and my row was the longest row. And I said, look, I got the most presents. I win. And when I tell that story, I'm always a little disappointed that friends of mine now don't seem particularly surprised that I would say something like that. But my mother responded with something which I have never forgot. She said, Georgie, the winner is not the one who gets the most presents. The winner is the one who gives the most presents. Now, that was a bummer because, I mean, I was 5 years old. I hadn't got anybody anything. Mother did all the shopping. But I never forgot that statement. And my mother was not just talking off the top of her head. She was a woman who dedicated her life to helping people less fortunate than she was. And she died. A major hospital in Detroit established an annual award, which they called the Humanitarian Award, and they named it after my mother. The thing was that most of the stuff she did was completely unknown to anybody. We're still discovering things. My mother died about 30 years ago, but we're still discovering things that she did for people that we knew nothing about. And so that wonderful sense of giving rather than getting was something that I grew up with. I didn't necessarily absorb it very well. And it really was when I got into AA that I started to learn what this was all about. And I think that's when we're talking about the 12th step, we have a one step that starts off with not just, you know, we did this or we did that. It starts off with a premise, having had a spiritual awakening. And so what's all that about? You know, what is the spiritual awakening? And for me, what that has meant, when I came in the program, and I think this is probably true of all of us, I mean, my question was, what can you guys do for me? I mean, I got all these problems and all this, and can you help me? It was, everything was about what can I get from AA? And, of course, they said what you can get if you give us a try and stick with the program is you're going to get sobriety. I remember my first meeting in 1974 in Detroit. It's an old Detroit group, and I showed up there. And so they started, they knew it was my first meeting. I didn't have to tell them that. I didn't look very good. And, as I look back at it, it was kind of surprising. They started off with, they didn't tell me I was the most important person at the meeting. They made it quite clear that I was the least important person there as far as they were concerned. And they said, you know, George, nobody called us and told us you were coming. We were going to be here anyway. And we're here to share our stories and to help ourselves, each of us, individually, to keep sober. And so if you go out and drink again, we're not going to lose a wink of sleep over it because you're the one that's going to get drunk, not us. But then they said, but if you are having trouble with your drinking and want to do something about it, you're in the right place. And you're welcome here. So they gave me an assignment of going home that night and not having a drink. So I think I could do that. And well, I wasn't sure, but I'd give it a try anyway. So I did. And they said, well, we'll see you tomorrow and we'll talk some more. And so it's pretty much been like that ever since. Starting off in AA with a sense of what am I going to get out of it? For me, over time, and I'm thinking for a lot of people, at some point we start thinking about not only what are we getting from AA, but what are we giving back? At some point, we have a crossover where all of a sudden you define AA experience is not by what am I getting, but what am I giving. I think that moment is the spiritual awakening, when you're about giving rather than getting. And so how do we give? Well, I mean, you have to ask that question. You're not paying attention. There's so many ways. I mean, one thing, anybody can appoint himself or herself as the most important service position in AA, and that's the meeting greeter. That newcomer, the first person they meet, makes them feel welcome. So you just go stand by the door and say hello to people and greet them, and you're off to the races on service in AA. The opportunities are many. And we have, of course, in AA, really two kinds of service. One would be called group service, which is, you know, running the meetings and making the coffee. It's stuff that has to be done. I mean, in my first home group, they had a policy that a newcomer, when they had 4 months of sobriety, became the chairman of the group. And I didn't know that, but when I got my 4 months and they came and said, we're making you chairman of the group. And I thought, boy, you know, I'm on my way in AA. Well, okay, let me show you your responsibilities. And he took me over to the broom closet and opened it up and said, okay, here's the brooms and here's the ashtrays you've got to clean. And that's your responsibility as chairman of the group. So I learned quickly that there's no glory in service. There is simply work that needs to be done. If you hear groans near you, don't worry. It's just members of my home group who are, as I start to tell a story, are thinking, oh my God, I got to listen to this again. I've heard it 1,000 times already. But I've had a in my bonnet about the idea of the way we describe things in AA. And it started it off as I was talking to, I'm sort of the grumpy old-timer in my home group, but I was talking to a grumpy old-timer from Ohio. And in Ohio, they got some real old-timers and real grumpy ones. And so I was talking to him, and he was complaining. He says, you know, when I came on the program, if somebody asked you if you were working the program, they weren't asking you if you were going to meetings or had a sponsor or any of that stuff. What they were asking you was, are you helping carry the message? And that's what working the program meant. And I responded to that because I've sort of had a bee in my bonnet about a phrase which I hear a lot in AA now, which is service work. And I just wish we could drop the word work from that and call it what it is, service. Words are important. And I think when we add work on there, it makes service sound like a job we do. But service is not a job we do. Service is an expression of this spiritual awakening that we have. And so maybe start a little seed going, and we start. You know, I was recently asked to serve on the National Board of Directors of another 12-step program, Debtors Anonymous, which is a very interesting program. I have a trustee of another board had recently retired and they needed a replacement, and it turns out I have a friend that was on that board. I didn't even know he was on the board, but he put my name in, and so now I'm doing that. It's a wonderful program, but the first thing I noticed is they never, ever use the phrase service work. Everything is service in their speech, in their literature, everything. And I will end this little diatribe on service work by saying I've read, I think, everything that Bill Wilson wrote. I don't believe he ever used that phrase. He always talked about service. I can figure out where I'm at here. One thing Bill did say in a Grapevine article, he says all progress in AA could be summed up in two words: humility and responsibility. And I think the humility probably doesn't surprise people. We admit we were powerless, and there's humility there. But the idea of responsibility, a little different, and we may be powerless over a lot of things, but we take responsibility for the things we do. That's part of the spiritual awakening, I think, is stepping up and taking responsibility. And and the one subject I like just a minute about, what we're talking about, when we're talking about carrying the message, we're talking about communication, of course. And it is absolutely incredible what has happened in just the last 10 years. In 2006, there was no Twitter, there were no iPhones, Facebook was a little deal that for college students that nobody cared about. Anybody remember Friendster and MySpace and everything? But there was no iPads, there's no Kindle reader. Did I mention Twitter? No Twitter. And look what's happened. The problem used to be was how do you get the message out to people? That's changed. The problem now is getting the AA message out amidst a cacophony of misinformation and uninformed personal opinion that's floating around. And that's a problem that we are really facing. And how we deal with that, I don't know. I think it's people much younger than I am are going to be the ones to figure out how to deal with this. But the whole world of communication, which is so important to AA, has changed. I think also, I mean, just things happen. There's somebody puts a thing on Facebook or does something and it's sort of the criticism of AA. And immediately, and really in violation of our traditions about not getting involved in public controversy, a number of people write back and call the person a jerk and doesn't know what he's talking about, all this stuff. And I have no idea how to deal with all that, but that's an important part of our future in AA, I think, is how to deal with this massive infusion of information, and to have the AA message be a clear and authoritative voice that could be sorted out from all of that. I think because I'm pretty much at the end, I think. But like all of you, I mean, I love AA. I want the best for it. I guess as long as I'm just freewheeling here for a second, it's my belief that we should listen to our critics, not try and shut them up. We should listen to what they have to say. There may be some truth in some of the things that they say about us, or not. But that's the way we should treat it. We should treat it as something that we should consider. As you know, there was a recent article in the Atlantic Monthly that was somewhat critical. And based on books by a very highly qualified psychiatrist. And I just don't think we should respond with anger or refutation or anything of that sort. I think we should read carefully what they are saying and really take our own inventory and say, is there really something there or not? And I think we are better off with that approach than we are by trying to mount a campaign against somebody that has been criticizing us. So that's it for me. Glad to have a chance to listen.
Thank you. So there I am in New York City on a street corner drunk and ran into a fellow who was on his way to an AA meeting. And I accompanied him to the meeting. And I found myself sitting there, and the meeting went on, and I was listening and hearing. And then there came a point in the meeting where they had a break. And they asked if there were any newcomers or anybody at their first meeting. Now, given that I was drunk, that's usually when I couldn't shut up. So I raised my hand, stood up, and began to deliver a monologue about my mother, creativity, alcoholism. And I was really sort of just getting started. And all I remember were these hands on my shoulder, sitting me back down in the chair, and a voice saying, "It's going to be all right." And that voice has never left me. It hasn't always been great, but knowing that I had found the right place was incredibly important to me. And I'm certainly grateful to have been there and grateful to be here. And we have one more speaker, Deb from Vermont.
Hi, I'm Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Williston Work It Group in Williston, Vermont. I feel really fortunate to have gotten sober in Chittenden County in Vermont. We're all really excited about our sobriety there. And that excitement has certainly kept me coming back. And so I'm very honored to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope on the 12th step with you today. So, my prayer was that when I opened my mouth, something would come out. So, so far it's working. So, I was thinking about when I walked into the door of Alcoholics Anonymous for my first meeting, and began my experience with carrying the message. It had began actually about 8 years before. 1974 when one of my friend's husbands had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he really needed it. And he carried on with his sobriety, and I carried on with my drinking with his wife. And so about 8 years later, I found myself in the depths of alcoholism, broken, frightened, and nowhere to go. Now, my husband was my best drinking partner, and so he wasn't paying any attention to how much I was drinking, right? And I was really angry because I was killing myself and no one was noticing. Well, one morning, on a Sunday morning, I was sitting at my dining room table, and it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. I was looking at the paper, and I had already had to throw back a shot or two of Jack Daniels. And this friend of ours walked into the back door, and he was looking for my husband. And he started to leave, and I was given that moment of clarity, just that second that we get. And I told him that I thought I was an alcoholic. And he turned around and he came back to me and he hugged me up in his arms and he sat down, and for the first time in 8 years, he shared his story with me. So I am really a believer of walking the walk and being patient for those people that we love to notice that there is a different way of life. So he did what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, women work with women and men work with men. And he left and he called a woman who called me. And we set up a time to go to my first meeting. And I walked into that meeting, and I was shaking really about like I'm shaking right now. And I sat on my hands throughout the whole meeting. But in that time, I heard some hope. And women came around. They gave me their numbers. I went home. I didn't want their numbers. And I went home, and but they did tell me to come back tomorrow, and I was graced to walk back into that room of Alcoholics Anonymous the next day, 24 hours later, and I had not had to pick up a drink, and that was the first grace that I got here. And through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to pick up a drink or a drug since that day. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to know what you could do for me. And I had no clue of how I was going to get myself out of the fine mess I had made. But, you know, the women carried me. They told me what to do. And I was so broken that I was willing to do what they told me to do. And that was, don't pick up a drink and come to a meeting. And, you know, it wasn't too long. I joined a group. I found a sponsor. The woman who graciously walked me into my first meeting told me to start paying attention and listening, and there would be someone who I wanted to ask to be my sponsor. And that happened, and that woman's still my sponsor today. So that is how it was displayed to me from the beginning, and, you know, that's how it continues to work for me. So I came, you know, my first job was cake baker. You know, I've had the privilege of being a GSR and do service work, you know, for the Public Information Committee and a variety of things. The greatest gift that I've gotten, though, has really been to be able to sponsor other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And without them, I would not be sober today. And, I don't know why I am so blessed, but I am. And I have several sponsees, really. And, you know, we stay in touch and we're continuously working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things that was brought to me early on was to go to a step meeting every week, and that's what I continue to do. And that's what they do, too. We make a point of getting ourselves in front of each other once a week at our home group most of the time. Every year, when it comes to be their anniversary, we sit down and we do an inventory of the year. And from some miracle, you know, they stay around. Now, that doesn't mean that every woman that I've sponsored has stayed around. We all know how that goes. But they have kept me sober by carrying the message and giving back to me what was so graciously given to me from the women who came before. So I was thinking also about the importance of carrying the message on the group level. So I have had only two home groups since I got sober, and the first one was a fabulous group. It met every day, and I needed that kind of guidance every day, and it had a variety of meetings, big books, and a speaker, Living Sober, As Bill Sees It. So I really had an opportunity to hear from some wonderful sober people, just the variety that would pass my way in my years of sobriety. And eventually I got a job and did all those things that we get to do as we pull ourselves out from the pits of our lives. And so I joined the group that I belong to now. And we are really, we have a big group, not so much a big group as we have a very active group conscience every month. And so we're always thinking about how is our group carrying the message to the newcomer who walks in. Because we we have some very long-term sobriety in our group. And we're noticing that we weren't having a lot of newcomers show up at our meetings. And so we created some jobs and we did what we could do to change that around. And the miracle has happened that our group is now full of all these vibrant, fabulous young women and some men who have come forth and just bring so much into our group that draws other people. The good news about getting some time is that life gets a lot easier. I guess it's the bad news is that we get older. So I got this really sweet little sponsee 3 or 4 years ago. And actually, I worked with her for 2 years. And she got sober. She had a really rich little program. And then she stopped coming to meetings for a while. And so when I spoke at a meeting and she came up to me and she asked me to sponsor her, and so I said, well, let's sit down and talk about, you know, how that might work for us. And so she had not gone out, but she had, you know how we are when we're a couple years sober. We start to know it a lot. And so she said, you know, I just am looking around the rooms, and, I just don't think that people, you know, have what I want. You know, I look around the rooms and, you know, they're like all, she didn't say you, but all of you older women sitting around. And, you know, you're not looking like really happy. You're like this and, you know, that kind of thing. And she said, I just have to think, I don't want what you have, you know. So I started laughing because that's what I do a lot with my sponsees. And I said, well, let me just tell you what really happens when you're lucky enough to get to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. Gravity has its way with it. And you can make a choice of being like joyful and happy inside and letting gravity have its way with us. Or you can go back and sit on a bar stool, and then when you come back, when you're all of our age, we'll see how it panned out for you. So I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. I love working with women. I love that I don't know much, but I do know that the life that I've been given as a result of staying sober is one that I can hold my head up and be proud. You know, I came in here, I have three daughters, and I was really getting afraid of them, for them. I was driving them drunk all the time. And my two oldest were teenagers, and they were starting to experiment. And today, you know, there are young women. I have grandchildren. All three of my daughters texted me this morning, and they love that they have a sober mother. And I hope that I have carried the message to them, which is a little bit of another thing that I really want to talk about. You know, in the big book, in the 12 and 12, when we get to most married folks, and we all like roll our eyes. Who wants to hear that, right? But that part of the reading for me is about bringing, carrying the message into my home. And when I got here, I got to do a lot of practicing with you folks. You loved me until I loved myself. You walked me back into having a little bit of self-esteem and some clarity. You taught me how to say no and stop being a people pleaser. And so I worked on that with all of you. Thank you very much. And then I got to take that into my home, because in my home, see, I could get away with all of my shenanigans, because that's just how Debbie is, right? And so my family were, is that unconditional love that people have to go to Al-Anon to learn how to do differently, right? And so anyhow, I got to start carrying the message into my home, which meant that my children began to be able to trust that I meant what I said. And, you know, all of those things that I really didn't know how to do until I got here, and you taught me how to be. I thought I had to run around and be a million different people to everybody. And you midwifed me into coming into my authentic self. So now when I meet people and I go to my home and I'm a newcomer in a new room, I show up in this one body. And my mind isn't like everywhere trying to figure out who it is that you want me to be. So I love Alcoholics Anonymous because it has given me just a settlement in my soul. So if you, by any chance, are new here at this convention, you're in the right place. You don't need to question that anymore. And I love all of you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous for what it has given to me. I do just want to take a second, though, to say that my grand sponsor is here, and some of my sponsees are here, and two of them are actually celebrating an anniversary on this July 4th weekend. I think that's awesome that they get to come here and celebrate. I think it's 26 years and 8 or 9. So, you know, that's what I get, is that I get to jump up and get on the plane in Burlington, Vermont at 6 o'clock in the morning, go to the airport, have everybody going, woo, 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 you know, everybody's looking around, what the heck's going on. We hop on the plane and we fly down here. The party started. It hasn't stopped. You know, we walk around and meet all of you new people from all over the world. It's the most amazing thing that we get to be a part of. So thank you so much for letting me be a part of your day today, and enjoy the rest of the conference.